Hey everybody, it's Mike Jeffers, Chicago Jazz Magazine, chicagojazz.com, and welcome to the Chicago Jazz Audio Experience Podcast. I'm excited to be on the phone with Ben Wolf, the incredible bassist. I could list off all of the people Ben has played with and all of the different experiences, but we don't have time for that because we need to get into talking about his new recording that's coming out called Fatherhood, and I'm going to let him talk about it. Honoring his father, but it's a very interesting story on how this whole thing came about, and it's coming out August 30th, so by the time you're listening to this, it will be out. It'll be out on Apple Music, Amazon, CD Baby, all the different places that you can pick up and stream, download, and also buy physical copies, and also Ben Wolf, WOLFE.com. We'll link all that stuff up as well, but Ben, thanks for taking a few minutes to talk about this incredible project you put together.
Oh man, thanks for having me. I very much appreciate it, and it means a lot to have an opportunity to talk about this record, CD, well, whatever you want to call it. I still call them records.
So, I know. Records are coming back too, so you know that's true. Reading over the info that we got just about the recording, and this is why I thought it was a really great story. I'm always looking for great stories, and I think a lot of our listeners always love hearing behind the scenes and why things came about. But you recorded this. I mean, you've been on different record labels. You put out a lot of different recordings under your own name, and in addition to being on a lot of different recordings. But this particular recording, Fatherhood, this is a tribute to your father. And let's talk a little bit about how it came about. Obviously, your father, Dan Wolf, passed away in 2018, I think I read. But it looked like he was a musician as well and a pretty accomplished one.
Yeah, well, here's the thing. My father did pass away last year. And he played one season with the San Antonio Symphony, but then he quit music. But so he stopped being a professional musician many, many years ago. But he loved music. And when I started playing music as a kid, he was very, I loved it, man. He was very, like, it was kind of like having a coach as the dad kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, so if I was talking on stage, I remember in high school, it's like, you know, I was embarrassed. Me and your grade school music teacher were out there listening to you play, and we were embarrassed by how professional you were being on stage. First of all, I wasn't getting paid, so I was unprofessional because I was talking on stage. You know, it's just like, you can't do that. You got to, you know, you get mad with talking on stage or playing out a tune. And it's kind of funny now because now I talk on stage the whole time, nonstop, you know. But he taught me a lot of those kinds of lessons, you know, things not like go up there and show people what you can do, but go up there and play for the music. He's always about, you know, getting good sounds, not showing off, you know, trying to play stuff that's beautiful, not just trying to impress a crowd. He was very into that type of, you know, musicality. So I learned a lot of that from him. And he was hard on me in a very good way. You know, I remember once, can I tell you two quick ones?
Sure, yeah, of course, yeah, definitely.
I was playing electric bass at the time, so I got these new strings. I was real excited. You know, I was doing gigs in high school. We had a little group. So my dad came to the gig, and I go, "Dad, what'd you think of those new strings?" And he looks at me and says, "You didn't play one note in tune all night." That was the end of this conversation. But I love it. And another time, I got my first polytone bass amp. I don't use amps anymore. And a pickup or something. And I was real young, you know. And my dad was in the kitchen. I said, "Dad, check it out. I sound just like Ron Carter." And he turns and looks at me and says, "Son, you sound nothing like Ron Carter." And that was it. But it was great because when I played well, or he was very supportive, and you know, that's the point where he was overly proud. You know, but when he passed away, you know, I wanted to. One of the first I thought, I'm going to make a record for my dad. You know, mm-hmm. and it wasn't that I'm going to write a bunch of songs to honor him about him. It wasn't so much that. It was more, I'm going to make this record in the way that I know he would encourage me to make it.
Yeah.
So he, you know, so all my decisions were kind of based on hearing him say, no. Use the studio you want to use. Just do it. No, do this, do that. He would really encourage me to do things the way I wanted to do them musically, if I could. Mm-hmm. You know, so on this record, you know, I spent some money and great studio, Sears Sound. I got this incredible engineer, Todd Whitelock. I got all the musicians I wanted to play with. I was very involved in how we recorded. We all played in the same room. You know, no one was wearing headphones, any of that. And I was very involved in every aspect. As a painter, I know, who incredible painter. I used one of his paintings for the cover and the packaging. So I was involved in every aspect of this recording, package, everything. I mean, I didn't do everything because I would learn what I didn't know, and I had help from people.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that's how I sort of honor him on this record. I tried to play the music I think he would like in a way that he would like. So,
you know,
it's also about my son too. I have a 13-year-old son, so it's not just about my father passing. It's also about, you know, what it's like being a father as well. So it's kind of both.
That's what I was going to ask you, because in some of the press stuff that I got, that's the other side of it too, right? Because you have a son, so it's like you're
exactly
thinking of it both sides, which is interesting to me. But when
completely.
And,
but it's even deeper. I mean, even like the liner notes written by Robin G.G. Kelly, who wrote this amazing book on Monk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which changed an incredible book, which I just, you know, I loved it. To me, it's one of the best books on jazz I've ever read, if not the best. And my father turned me on to Thelonious Monk when I was a kid. My son, when he was like 7, looked at me once, or even younger, said, Thelonious Monk sounds like he's off, but he's not. He's playing real jazz. So there's even, and I used to even live on Thelonious Monk Circle one time. So there's a connection even there with Robin Kelly doing the liner notes. So everything about it has some kind of connection. Not even stuff that necessarily people would even know, but for me, I know. You know what I mean? How does it make sense? But.
Yeah, no, it does. And that's the beauty of this recording, right? Because, I mean, it's going to live on, especially in your memory, in you forever, because of the way you
right.
put the whole thing together. It's not something that wasn't thought out thoroughly. And, you know, let's talk a little bit about the recording too, because you talked about how your father, well, and just listening to you talk about how your father was talking to you about talking on stage when you were young and talking about your strings and talking about this, you're right. He does sound like a, you know, like a overzealous football dad or somebody, you know, instead of telling his son what to do. But that probably goes hand in hand with why you thought about all the different musicians you picked, because he probably would have sat there and said, that guy's exactly what you need for this kind of a recording, or that's exactly the right guy.
Well, he wouldn't have said that stuff now.
Oh, okay.
The code part of it, so to speak, that ended a long time ago, but that was, it's like he knew when to stop doing that.
Right.
Which was, you know, when I was very young, once I, you know, a professional musician for years, he is more like we just shared a love of music. We talked about, he would call me, what records you're listening to. It was more of that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But he would also tell me what he liked. Like he'd watch gigs that I would do online, and he'd have no problem being honest what he thought.
That's great. That's so awesome.
I mean, but you know, but I loved it. You know, I mean, it was great. It was positive though. It wasn't negative in any way, in my opinion.
No, he was trying
and
to help you.
Definitely helped me.
Yeah,
totally.
He was trying to help you. It wasn't like he was trying to beat you down. And there's a big difference in that.
Exactly.
And that's exactly what it sounds like. And obviously, so let's talk, actually, since you brought this up earlier and he played strings, is that why you got into bass?
No, I don't, you know, I don't think so. I started off, you know, my whole music thing was, you know, I was in a sports as a kid like everyone else. And my best friend in grade school, we were very competitive with each other in everything we did, and he was in the band and I wasn't. He was like the best musician in the school, and I was like, well, you know what, I'm gonna come play. So we were competitive, so I started playing. I just picked a tuba for some reason, and then me and this friend of mine, every day at lunch we'd go into a practice. He taught me how to play. He was like my first private teacher.
Wow.
And it was like, all when I started doing it, it was like, wow, this feels really, it felt very natural and comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it was like I found something that, wow, I didn't really know I've always loved music, but I didn't plan on being a musician necessarily. I wasn't really thinking about it. And then I started playing in seventh grade, and then I never stopped. And I never knew, you know, I didn't even know it. When I got to high school, I assumed if you start playing music, that's what you're going to do for a career. I didn't know you could play music just for fun.
Oh.
I don't know why I didn't know that. So I never got to high school, like the second year in high school, like that long. Someone in the band mentioned they're going to go to college to be a doctor or something. And I was like, what? You're in the band. Like, I didn't even consider that anybody would want to do anything else. I just didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
So once I started playing, that's what I was. I'm a musician now.
Wow.
But it was very easy for me at first. It came like natural in a way. It's like I found my home, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when we got to work, me and my dad, when he saw I was serious about it. But I didn't start on bass. I kind of worked my way through it. And when I got to high school, they had me play a lot of different instruments. They told me to play electric bass. They told me to play acoustic bass. I was playing bass trombone. I was playing the tuba. But I wasn't really into, and I was like a classical tuba player. But then electric bass, being a teenage high school in the 70s, that made things better for me.
I formed
a funk band, played high school dances. And then I started playing some jazz. And I kind of worked my way there, but I was all over the place. But I was, you know, like a teenager, just playing in top 40 bands. But when I got to the acoustic bass seriously, that's when I knew this is it. This is what I'm going to do. But it wasn't until I was like 19 that I knew that was what it was. And then I got very serious about it.
Wow.
But after that, I was just sort of like, it was like a playground to me in a way.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't clear. I didn't know it wasn't clear, but it wasn't clear. But once I started, you know, really, when acoustic bass showed up, in high school I played, I don't really count that. But it was home. But I will say this, I know I'm kind of going over this with you right now. There was a moment in high school that was really interesting where we played one of those stage band contests, high school stage band, whatever, you know, they had those contests, and we were doing a Count Basie tune, and the band director said, you got to play acoustic bass on this one song. And we didn't have any kind of amps or pickups for the acoustic bass. So they put a mic on the bass at this, and this is like in the 70s, on the bass. And the judges were like, man, that's incredible. You're playing without an amp and just a mic on the bass? And I said, okay, yeah, that's all we have. It didn't mean anything to me at the time. But the irony is now that's what I do. I haven't used an amplifier in over 30 years or
really?
A pickup. So that became what I do. I've now played with gut strings. So it's kind of funny. That was sort of like what ended up happening. And my father, at the time, he told me, I know you love Earth, Wind & Fire. That was my plan. I wanted to be in Earth, Wind & Fire. Speaking of Chicago.
That's a good plan.
that was my plan, to be in Earth, Wind & Fire. You know, 16 was my plan. You know, I have to learn all those songs. And my dad's like, I know you love all those bands, but trust me, you're going to be into the early jazz acoustic bass players later. I'm like, all right, whatever. You know, not back to shining star. So a lot of these things that I remember, he was more, I thought he was kidding around. He was right, though, a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
Good stuff.
Well, and he could see your passion, but he knew the progression of what happens because, I mean, most bass players, right? I mean, most musicians, you hear them get into the music in one way, and then they slowly find their way through, and then the next thing they know, you know, they find Thelonious Monk,
exactly.
Or they find different guys like that, and all of a sudden they're like, whoa, what's that? And then it takes them right down that wormhole, and now you're into that whole side of the music too. And, you know, it sounds like to me, I mean, listening to this recording, Fatherhood, by the way, that's out now as you're listening to this podcast. When I'm listening to it, it sounds like there's a lot of different eras that you wrote for in this. I mean, with the strings, there's a couple of songs. One of them's in particular is Gone Now. It just reminded me of a different era with the strings. It sounds more like a 1940s kind of a tune. I don't know if you thought that way when you were writing this, writing the compositions, but it seems to me when I'm listening to it, I hear different eras in music in that, and it's almost like I was wondering if that's something that you consciously made a decision to do or if that's just kind of naturally how it all came out of you.
No, I don't. To me, it's all modern music. I know what you mean. I understand exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
But I don't consciously, let's try to get a type of sound as far as era-wise.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's more the influence. I mean, to me, jazz music's all modern music. It's all new. I mean, if they're recordings or videos of the pioneers of something, it's got to be pretty new.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, you're right.
But I totally understand what you're saying. I know, but I didn't plan it that way. I didn't, you know, I just write, and but I don't try to play in an era, so to speak.
How did you?
I think it's more just influence coming out, you know. But I do know that part of it is the recording, because these days they don't make, very often they don't make records out like that way. Put people in separate rooms, mm-hmm. and they have all this isolation. I'm not saying that's bad, it's just a different sound. So we didn't record that way. We used to hear a lot of the air in the room, which is how they used to record all the time. So there's some of that, but it wasn't like I was trying to make a nostalgic, just try to sound like it was, I wasn't trying to do that on purpose.
No, but I was just trying to play. I thought it was interesting, too, because, I mean, it seemed to me after reading about how this is, how you were remembering your father when you were writing this, I was thinking maybe you were picking up some themes from different songs or different artists that maybe you were coming to mind as you were putting this together in relationship to your father and your past and stuff.
In fact, this is the first record where all these songs were already written before.
Oh, really?
None of them were written for the record. Oh. They were arranged and orchestrated for the record.
But all these tunes, the whole
thing is dedicated to my father, but the songs weren't written for him. I mean, there are connections with him. The songs I chose, like The Enforcer, is dedicated to his great NBA player from the 70s, Maurice Lucas, who I hung out with him once, and my father hung out with him once on a different occasion. Like, we both encountered him, and we used to watch him, in the 70s when he played. So there was a connection, but the songs weren't written for him that way.
That's it. Were you writing these compositions in different, obviously you just kind of had them stockpiled, and then when this came about, you decided
I write all the time. But these are, like, I play a week at Dizzy's every year, so I have different music for that gig, and, like, for instance, there's a song there called The Cora Law. That's the first, movement and a half of, a 40-minute suite I wrote called From Here I See, and I rearranged it for this record. That song Edged I wrote probably 10, 15 years ago, but I rearranged it for this record.
Ah, okay.
Line 7 is on my first record in the 90s. Just Canvas Quartet, Winton plays on it. Gone Now is a song I wrote in the last 5 or so years, 7 years, but I never recorded or performed it. That's the same with It's True. I wrote that in the last 5 to 7 years, but I never performed it. So I took the song. They're like, piano, I play them on the piano. So I took the song and I arranged and orchestrated them for the record, for the musicians I had and that kind of thing. So that's more about how this the song came about on this one.
Well, I'll tell you, listening through it and listening to the order and all that stuff, I mean, it's fascinating to me, because as somebody who gets a lot of recordings sent over to listen to, and you get a lot every single month and you're getting them submitted and all that stuff, but the flow of this entire recording, that's why I had those questions, because the flow of the recording just kept me interested throughout the entire recording, because there was always something new coming at you in each composition and each track. And I never felt like there was any redundancy in it. But it makes sense, I think, too, because, you write something, for your recording back in the 90s, and then you write something 10 years later, your experiences are different, obviously, and you're adding to that. So as a composer, I mean, how do you go about sitting down? Because I'm always curious when I listen to composers, because, I'm just a drummer who can't write music, so that's why I like to talk to people that can. So, as a composer, what do? You sit down, do you think of themes? Do you think of who you're going to be recording with? Do you think of, how does, a composition come out initially?
Okay, well, all the above, it really depends. That's a great question, but it's not one answer. When I'm arranging and orchestrating, I'm very aware of who's going to be playing. That's what, like on Blind 7, I knew who was playing on it, and I thought it makes sense that we did it where we don't put the melody right away and that kind of thing. But also, we've been playing this song in my band for years, so what I did was I took what we did on the original recording of it, which just tenor saxophone, trumpet, bass, and drums. And this new version, which sounds nothing like that, is actually a very abstracted version of that first one. For instance, on the original record, The record's called 13 Sketches. We played Blind 7. When the song ends, all of a sudden I start playing again, and me and Wynton play like trumpet and bass duet, and it fades out, which is something we should do a lot in his band. He'd come over and whisper in my ear, keep playing, keep playing. Mm-hmm. So we did that on that original version of Blind 7. On this new version of Blind 7, wherever you think the song ends, all of a sudden the bass and drums start playing. So it's like I did it again in a different way.
Yeah, you know, okay, so sure.
I have this, so there's a so it's it. There's things I play even in the, there's like some certain rhythms we play in the bass and drums that are similar to the first version, but we do it messier. It's not. It's like just a reference to it. So it's kind of like conceptual quotes, if that makes any sense at all.
Yeah.
Now, but the other stuff, you know, it's like Gone Now. I was just trying to like almost like write just a pretty ballad. I write a lot of ballads, and I try to write melodies that could be sung with lyrics, even though it's not being sung, and there are no lyrics, but where the melody's clear that way. I try to write clear melody. But I've written so much music. For me, it's not hard to write. Like, it doesn't mean it's going to come out good, but I'm able to sit down and write music. It's not like I'm not going to get writer's block.
Right.
I can write, but it doesn't mean what comes out is going to be good. But I'm able to keep going, you know. But so I have different concepts. Sometimes I'll sit down and I'll just play some kind of bass line on the piano and see where it leads me. Sometimes I'll have a person I'm trying to write for and see where it goes.
Mm-hmm.
But once it starts, it kind of has a life of its own, and I just write till it's done.
You know,
and I use different concepts I use. There's different harmonic things I use. There's certain types of chords I will use at certain times for certain reasons. You know, there's those kind of things. But it's not like one, you know, it's a hard question. Great question.
No, I know it's not an answer that can be done in like 2 seconds. So I apologize for putting you on the spot.
No,
but
I
love talking about that stuff. And you went down a little bit of a path, and I just want to touch on it, and then we're going to jump back over because I'm curious to see, you know, talk a little bit about the musicians that are on this recording,
yeah.
Fatherhood. But for the musicians and the composers that are listening to this recording, we get a lot of them listening to this. I think what you said there is very important, is that you write, and it's not always good, but you're writing. And I think that half the battle is sitting down and actually like doing it, and then figuring it out. Because if you sit around and think about writing and try to conceive something that's perfect in your mind, it's never going to happen. So it sounds like that's what you do. You just sit down and say,
well,
hey, I'm going to get an idea.
I mean, it's like when people practice, say, soloing over the changes of a song. They just do it. It might not sound good, but they're trying to develop a skill. You got to be able to do this thing. A lot of times with composing, I think, because you're actually doing the thing, it's not an exercise, so to speak. You know, if you don't like it, you get frustrated and you stop. But I think it's important to learn to be able to just do it. I mean, I have an exercise I've had students do in my composition classes or whatever, where I would say, look, you have 5 minutes to write a complete song right now. Go, 5 minutes, maximum.
Mm-hmm.
And the only requirement, the only one requirement is that you finish. Nothing else matters. Doesn't matter how it sounds, doesn't matter how long it is. The only requirement is that you finish your 5 minutes. It can be an 8-measure song.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can train yourself to be able to just write something, then you start learning just the skill of doing it. It's like walking bass line. I mean, you know, if you never actually sit at home and play chord notes on the bass, you're not going to ever be able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to just do it. It'll just learn the craft, the skill. That way, when you try to make some art, you'll have some kind of technique to it. And I think writing's the same way.
I totally agree.
For me.
I totally agree. I think half the battle with artists, especially, is just getting started to doing something, and then once you're doing
you
it,
can't
and doing
sit around
and doing
waiting
it.
For some kind of inspiration. I mean, that's great if it comes, but you gotta be able to create that for yourself. Sometimes just starting something, then the inspiration will come. Like if you don't get on the court, you know, that doesn't matter. So
exactly.
That's how I look at it. But I mean, everyone's different. That's the beauty of art. Everyone has their own ways. So,
I mean, absolutely. No, that's why I wanted to touch on that, because I thought you said something great there, and I wanted to make sure we clarified it, because I think that's important for people to hear. And, you know, jumping back to this recording, I mean, it's, you know, you had to start it, right? So you started it. You started arranging. You started figuring it out. You started deciding where you're going to record it, who's going to record it. But also you decided on the musicians that you're going to have on the recording. And let's talk a little bit about these musicians, because, I mean, every name I know on here, I mean, it's like a who's who all-star band here that you have on here. So why don't we talk a little bit about the musicians, your relationship to them, and how you decided on having them on this specific recording.
Okay. Well, the bass player, just kidding. Donald Evans, the drummer, he's on my last, I want to say, three records, I think. And we play together all the time. You know, we're brothers. We play together all the time. So we've been playing together a long time. And like I say, he's on the last three records.
Mm-hmm.
Luis Perdomo, he's on some earlier records. I had a band with him and Greg Hutchison for a while. And Marcus Strickland. So we made a couple records with that group. And Luis is, he can learn anything, man. He's an incredible musician. So we've been playing together for a long time. Oren Evans, we play together all the time as well. He's on a few of my records, three of my records as well with Donald. And we did a trio record with Donald, with Oren's record. Right now I'm writing a chart for his Captain Black Big Band's next record. I mean, so these are like family to me, these guys.
Yeah, yeah.
Joel Roth, he's from Chicago, right?
Yep.
So he's young, you know, he's up and coming. You know, he's getting all kind of press, which is great. You know, he's doing his thing. Beautiful, very busy. It's awesome. And and with him, I met him when he was very young, sounded good. And I kind of keep my eye on him. We did some gig one time with a big band, Evan Sherman Big Band. And he did this thing. I was like, okay, he's got something special. It wasn't playing fast. It was just he did some. I never forget. He did something where I was like, wow. He just made this whole band sound beautiful.
Hmm.
Like he did something. He had a special quality of playing that, you know, that I heard. So I started using him on Dizzy Dizzy's, and it felt great. So I called him for the record, man, because I've used Vibes in the past, you know. So, and he's a great guy, great musician, and I like the idea of combining like veterans and people I've played with for years with young musicians. Because I'm a big believer in the jazz scene. A community of musicians, not the us and them, the old cats, the young cats, and that's all true, but at the same time, it's one big family. So I wanted to show that on this record. Emmanuel Wilkins, the alto player, him and Joel are like best friends. They play together all the time. They're in each other. I believe that Emmanuel's in Joel's band.
Oh, okay. That's so where I recognize that name from. Yeah. Because they're coming into town. They're playing the Jazz Fest this weekend.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
He's doing all kind of stuff. So, like Joel, you know, these young cats, they're coming on now. And he's a special musician as well. It's the same kind of thing with Joel. You know, there's something very interesting and different I like about him. Ruben Fox is a young tenor player from London. And I just love how he plays ballads. Now, I met some of these people as... They were students, but I don't want to refer to these musicians as students. So that's why I'm not doing that.
Right.
But I met them in that instance. But I will never. I'm not going to. I'd rather not go into that part of it because I don't think of them as students. I think of them as peers.
Mm-hmm.
So Ruben Fox plays ballads so beautifully. He plays on Gone Now. So I just said, man, you want to come play this ballad? So I brought him in. It was, you know, to do that, and you know, it was play. He played beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
J.D. Allen, the tenor player, he's on. Some early records I've done. We used to play a lot with Oren and Donald Quartet, and you know he's got a beautiful sound. So I brought him in. You know, I've related to playing with him. Givdon Jelen is one of the young cats. He plays. Emmanuel Wilkins plays in Givdon's band. Like they're all part of these young up and coming guys.
Yeah.
Color players. He's amazing. Beautiful sound and a great dude and just a great musician. So I like again just combining. Different cats. Steve Davis, trombone player extraordinaire. How that came about was on this one song, I wanted to have a horn solo play just solo during the head out of this tune. But I was hearing it, I was imagining anyway, a very specific thing. And it came down to I either got to get Tom Harrell or Steve Davis. And I went with Steve. I used to play trombone, and me and Steve have never recorded together. I've known him for years. And so that's how that came in. And he sounds great. Came in and played just one section. You know, so that's the jazz musician. Now, the string players, I've done a few string records, and the first one I did, but the first one was a string quartet, first like that. No strangers here. I contacted this great violinist, Jesse Mills, he's played all kind of chamber music. He even recorded with Ornette, and he put together the quartet, and that happened as well on this record. So he hired these great people. Now, Cokie Bearstreet, the violinist, is also an amazing composer. He's on an earlier record as Wolfram Kessel, the cellist. He's on an earlier record. So these, I know them. But Jesse brought in the second violinist, Georgi Valchev. Sorry, mm-hmm. I said that wrong. So he put that together. I trust him. And Jesse's an incredible, just incredible musician and great at putting these things together. So that's the quartet. They're not really officially a quartet. These four string players, they were incredible, just amazing musicians, and it was tremendous having them.
I like to ask because, you know, some people like, well, I don't know any of these people, but I know that if I hire them on my, you know, on my recording, it's going to be great or whatever. But I figured that you had connections with a lot of them because I had seen them on some of your other recordings. And I think that's something that I was curious about. And the fact that you've got all these little connections to people, even like Joel Ross, who you don't play with a ton, but you have a specific reason why you have him on there. I think that's fascinating to me.
Yeah. I mean, you know, he played 2 years of music at a few gigs, but I just knew he'd be perfect for this, and he was.
Yeah,
he's on the majority of the record, Joel.
Yeah, yep. I heard that, and I, you know, just the whole flow of the whole thing is great. But I, you know, one last thing before we kind of wrap this up. Of course, we're talking to Ben Wolf. Fatherhood, his new recording is out. It's available at Apple Music, Amazon, CD Baby. You can get hard copies and downloads at Amazon and CD Baby, and of course all the other streaming places that you can think of. Also, Ben Wolf, WOLFE.com, BenWolf.com, and that's going to be having links, I'm sure, to everything for Fatherhood. But, you know, one last thing on this recording and everything is I'm kind of curious, you know, how important it is as a bass player to have a rhythm section that you play with on something like this. Like, you know, Donald Edwards, you play with a lot, so you guys can just lock directly in. I mean, I would think that you're coming in and you're going to record a bunch of tunes and everything, and if all of a sudden you're dealing with a different drummer or a different piano player or something that you're not quite used to playing with as much as you're used to playing with these guys, it would be a little bit more challenging, especially in a room with no headphones, no isolation. You kind of have to be nailing things right off the bat. Otherwise, there's going to be a lot of takes on it, right? So talk a little bit as a bassist in a rhythm section, how important it is, or not important, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but for you to be able to lock in and be comfortable with that piano player and that drummer to make things smooth, like right off the bat.
No, I agree. It's very important. But, you know, I think these things depend. I think there can be people that you've never played with where it can lock in and be incredible the first time. I think the people you play with for years, it might not be good that day. So I think it depends. You know, I've been in many situations where I play with people I've never played with and I felt great right away.
Mm-hmm.
Or people I've played with for years and I can't stand playing with. I've had that happen too. I mean, which is, I'm not blaming them. It's sometimes things just don't work. But as far as my particular projects, when I'm the leader, I'm going to give people on all the instruments that I feel will make sense for what we're doing, you know, so I can trust and understand what we're trying to do. But I mean, that hookup thing is with all the instruments that's always the big challenge, because I mean, it's so, to get it right is so difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to really get it right. I mean, you can, it's one thing to have a collection of people playing well at the same time, but to really get a band sound or an ensemble to play together as one is, that's always the big challenge, you know, because you can't make it happen by yourself. It has to be a collective, and you can't force a collective to be together. It just doesn't work. You know, it has to somehow, people have to agree. It's almost like a mini society, the bandstand. Mm-hmm. It somehow got to work, even with disagreements, even with whatever. Somehow the holes got to work as one. So to me, that's the beautiful part of music when that happens. And it, you know, it's like magic, you know. And I like to do things where I like to create an environment where there's a better chance of the magic occurring. You know. So.
No, that
abstract for you enough?
No,
But what was weird to me about making these records of my own, because when my cameras, I'm not really thinking about how much bass I'm going to play or something, you know? I'm just trying to, since I wrote all the music and I'm so involved with the whole thing that I'm not even like concerned about how I'm playing the bass.
Right.
The same way. I'm not trying to find my spots or make sure I do this, because that's a natural human thing to do. I mean, I'm always interested in hearing bass players as leaders. Like, I love hearing Chris McBride, when he played with his big band.
Oh, yeah,
I love it because, and I love it all, he always plays bass, but with his big band, since he does all the writing, it's just like he's just the bass. I don't know. Somehow it's different. And I relate to that because that's how I always feel when I'm playing with my own record. But you write all the music and you do all the orchestrating. It's almost like you forget, oh, yeah, I got to play bass now. You know what I mean? Oh, yeah.
Well, you take yourself out of that element. Yeah, you take yourself out of that element. And now you put yourself back into the element. And you're like, oh, yeah, that's right. I'm playing bass, too.
I mean, this record is not a bass record. You know, it's not like I play two solos. One of them is half a chorus and one's a chorus. And I'm just trying to get a, you know, but I want to get a good sound and play well, you know. So that's my dad again. You know, get a good sound, you know, play good notes.
Well,
make the band sound good.
I can tell you that you did. You achieved that,
thanks.
And it really sounds great. And Ben, I really appreciate you jumping on here on the Chicago Jazz Audio Experience. So let me just let everybody know again. So it's benwolf.com, and also Fatherhood, it's available now everywhere you can buy and download and purchase music, Apple Music, Amazon.com, CD Baby, just to name a few. Definitely go check this out. Hopefully, Ben, you're going to make it through Chicago at some time soon here.
I sure hope so.
Yeah, it'd be nice to have you playing live in Chicago, but congratulations on an incredible recording, and thanks again for jumping on today.
Thank you, bro. My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, definitely. And everybody, thanks for listening. Of course, you can get more information at ChicagoJazzMagazine.com, ChicagoJazz.com. Listen to more podcasts. We have videos up two or three times a week as well with interviews. And until next time, hopefully we'll see you somewhere out on the scene.